Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about 1974's noir mystery about water rights in Los Angeles back in the late 1930s. Boy, it sounds like dry material. Ha ha! It's directed by Roman Polanski, the award-winning, very talented, and now disgraced director who's currently in exile in Europe for raping and sodomizing a 13-year-old girl. Have to get that out of the way because it definitely colored my opinion of the third act of this film. Written by Robert Towne, who was brought on to write this the script to The Great Gatsby for $150,000 and said, I can't do it. I can't do better than Fitzgerald. How about I write this thing about Chinatown for $25,000? Sold, said Robert Evans, who we recently really enjoyed Matthew Good's portrayal of him in The Offer. That was on Paramount. Oh man, there's so many great The Offer callbacks in this movie, or I guess the title credits of this movie. It stars Jack Nicholson, Easy Rider, The Departed, Shining. Those are just the movies that we've got a podcast for. Legendary actor Faye Dunaway, star of Bonnie and Clyde, the original Thomas Crown Affair, Towering Inferno, and many others. John Hillerman, who's mostly famous to me for being Higgins and Magnum PI.
Okay. I was wondering, where have I seen this guy? That's exactly
right. Right. Burt Young, who is Polly from the Rocky films, and John Huston, legendary head of the Huston Hollywood family that includes Jack and Angelica. He also wrote and directed The Maltese Falcon, which I thought was interesting. That's my personal favorite noir film.
Never seen it.
This is widely considered one of the top 10 American movies of all time. What did you think of this film?
I liked it. I don't think that's any surprise, right? It's a very well-written script. It's extremely well-acted by the lead, the two leads. I mean, what's not to like about this movie? Maybe the ending, because the ending might frustrate you. But it's also what makes the movie powerful, I guess.
I like to film the thing about this film, I guess, that's really lauded is the screenplay itself. They say that it's like one of the perfect screenplays in the terms of its dialogue, in the terms of its pacing, in the terms of how they dole the mystery out and how it kind of twists and turns all the wheels within wheels of secrets and how they manage that. And I got all that, and I was like 2/3 of this film thinking this might actually dethrone the Maltese Falcon. And the way the third act goes, and like my knowledge, because that's the thing, I'd forgotten that Roman Polanski had directed this thing when we selected, did all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, I saw his name, like, God damn it, I'm gonna have to talk about him sodomizing some poor girl he groomed, and that's gonna be a bummer. But then when I saw I felt like there's a villain, that the villain has like a little mini monologue where I felt like for a minute Roman Polanski was kind of like defending himself. And I don't know if he intended it as such or what, but it took me out of the film, you know. But until that point, and also it's just bleak. It's a really bleak, depressing, Sisyphean ending.
Yeah, exactly.
So like it was a lot. It was a lot to take in on a Wednesday morning. But I'm trying to put aside my personal feelings about the director and the man behind the film, which I'm not saying is something you should have to do. But like, yeah, and it's the other thing is like I felt like this is similar to Godfather 2, where you could take a few watches to get everything this movie's putting out.
Yeah, for sure. I still have questions after a single watch. What did the names of these old people, why put the land under the names of these old people, right? Like the stuff like that. What's the purpose of that? And I'm sure the movie clues me in if I would watch it again and pick up every detail. But yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think the screenplay and the movie itself are strong enough to warrant a second watch, at least. And I can see people going back to this movie frequently because it does hold together really well.
Yeah. And it's like, it's kind of unique from my perspective, from like a noir film, and that the stakes are so high. Like, you know, when you say that, like, when something in a, you know, Humphrey Bogart film goes all the way to the top, maybe it's the mayor of a town or something. But this is involving, like, a multi-state conspiracy to, I don't know, like, enrich a bunch of oligarchs that are, like, you know, drying out farmers and taking advantage of poor immigrant families and all this other stuff. It's like he really uncovers something that's not just like a tawdry romance or an illegal liquor operation. It's like it's a real giant conspiracy. This movie's got a lot of balls that way. And the other thing is like I kept on reading about like how great the cinematography is on this film. I thought it was pretty pedestrian.
Interesting.
Meat and potatoes. But sometimes pre-90s films feel that way.
Yeah, that's the thing. In a 70s movie, I'm not calibrated. I'm not qualified enough to say, hey, the direction on this movie is amazing or whatever. Because I'm just not steeped in the 70s cinema in the way that film historians definitely are.
Yeah.
I would say there are things in there that are interesting for the time period. You don't often see a lot of the stuff that we see now, which is like, you know, the POV being of Jack Nicholson the entire movie and him.
That was really cool.
Like when he gets knocked out or something, the camera kind of fading out with him and fading back in. I think that was one of the techniques there that was surprising for the day new or novel. And beyond that, like I didn't notice much flourish. I hear a lot about the lighting and how it's very complicated and very well set up and. But I'm so used to modern cinema where lighting like that is taken for granted and
you got HDR stuff now because like right now it's like, well, they filmed this out in the desert at high noon. Everything's blindingly lit and slightly overexposed, but like it's nothing like you can do now with like modern cameras and with you got your high definition. Or what is that? What's HDR actually stand for? I forget.
High dynamic range.
High dynamic range lighting where it's like you really get blooms and like you really can simulate, you know, things blooming out and fading. There's something kind of dated. The camera's very static. It's not very dynamic. A lot of the gunplay, which is not a lot for, kind of detective, a private eye movie. It's the gunplay is kind of sloppy, not particularly well done. Some of the stage makeup is shockingly bad.
You know, let's talk about the makeup for a second, because I don't know. Do you want to get into like what the movie is about, and then we can kind of talk more details? Because I'm itching to talk about some of the things that this movie does subvert everything I expect of a film.
Well, so for the kids listening, and I include myself and definitely Jim in his category, that might bristle. Like, you know, it's like my son, like anytime we start a movie and it's shot before the year 2006, he's like, this looks like an old film, Dad. Like you can kind of tell from the stock and the lighting. Why would you go back? Why would you, if you're under the age of 30, hell, under the age of 40, why would you go back to this 1974 movie? Like what recommends it? Because we just talked about how like it's kind of dated in this way. It's dated in that way. This doesn't quite hold together. If you know anything about the director, you might have a big, you know, moral issue with consuming. What is this? What is to recommend this film?
I mean, I think it's
the plot we talked about, I guess.
Sure. I think the screenplay is very good. But also, I think like having some kind of perspective on the history of cinema is good. I don't have a huge amount of it. I've seen a handful of movies from like the 40s. I've seen a few more from like the 60s and the 70s, but I'm really steeped in like 80s and beyond. And I feel like going back to these older movies kind of clues me in as to the big leaps that were made like right at this era. Like you, and not even leaps necessarily that are good, but just changes in the industry, I guess. Especially around like Jaws. When you look at like Jaws coming out very shortly after this movie, right? It was like a year later or something. The movie industry just changed when Jaws came out. And like seeing this pre-Jaws thing where Robert Evans is putting stories up on screen that even he isn't like super thrilled with, but he trusts the talent involved. And they tell just like riveting stories that are in a lot of cases much more mundane than this story, but still very exciting in themselves. And then you look at like how it changes with the Jaws era of blockbusters and huge marketing budgets, and everything changes from focus on storytelling to focus on getting eyeballs on their stuff. And it's just like, I feel like that's the value of it. You see like what it was like before then and what it was like after then. And that's true of every era, right? There are changes in the 40s that happen, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, all of them. But yeah, I think there's value in just knowing the history.
There's also value, I think, if you only know Jack Nicholson from like The Departed or as the grandpa that sits beside all the Lakers games. It's interesting to go back and see him in his prime. Like every single, because I myself, until I think 2 years ago we saw Easy Rider, I don't think I'd seen a Jack Nicholson before The Shining, which is pretty late in his career, 1980s. And it's every time I go and see one of these early Nicholsons, I'm like, oh, I kind of get it. I understand why this guy was so mad. Like, you know, because like you see still photos of him and like, God, even when he was kind of young and in his prime, he's still balding and he's kind of like angular and he's got that weird kind of delivery, man. And like, what, why was he such a riveting kind of sex symbol? Why was he seen as this like man's man kind of guy? And like, you see him slip into essentially a Sam Spade type of role, a Dixon Hill. And I wouldn't think he'd be particularly good at it, knowing his body of work, but he kind of kills it, mostly with like the quintessential don't give a fuck of like a real good hard-boiled detective.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah, there's that element to it.
There's parts of this film, and I think he turns around, but like where like he's not even really bothered by the moral morass the city is in, because that's kind of his stock and trade. It's more of like, they've tried to cut off my nose despite my face, and I'm in it for purely personal reasons. I don't know. There's something that really, because like he doesn't do the like social engineering very well. Like every time he rolls into a situation where he's bluffing, it's like Jack Nicholson always looks like he's up to something. And to the movie's credit, the mark is always kind of like vaguely unsure and off to call the cops every time he like, yeah, I'm just going to go in this fucking door and do whatever the hell I want, sweetheart. But he's it's a landmark Jack Nicholson role. And if you don't get why he is such a big thing in Hollywood, it's kind of neat to go back and see, you know, these things where he's in his prime. Okay. So you want me to do the thing where I outline the thesis of the movie?
Yeah, let's do it.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well. Lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds. And now, back with more Bald Move. This is a complicated plot. I'm going to set you up for the first like 10, 15 minutes of it. Jack Nicholson is a private detective. His name is Jake
Geddes. I think is how he says it. Everybody says it differently, sometimes to insult him, sometimes just because they don't know. But
Right. And I think he says Geddes. He is hired by a wealthy water commissioner's wife to investigate marital infidelity.
Or is
which he does. That gets leaked to the press, and then the real wife of the wealthy commissioner shows up in his office and threatens to sue him for defamation because she did no such thing, and it's an entirely different woman. And this is his first indication that something's a lot deeper going on here in this city, in this valley, in this family. And he gets sucked into a struggle over real estate and water in the desert of Los Angeles that's going to go all the way to the top. And there are so many twists and turns, so many character reveals, so many moments where your loyalties and suspicion shifts. It's a lot of fun to watch. And it, to the extent that, like, I want to talk a lot about the ending. That's the spoiler free part. So if you want to, you know, go and enjoy Chinatown Unsullied, now's the time to bail out. Do you want to? Okay, let's. Is it weird to start at the ending?
I mean, the ending is what I think defines this movie. Sets it apart from so many other neo-noir type films.
Yeah, so, it's
sure.
What did you think? As like, there is a well-documented disagreement between Robert Town, the writer, and Roman Polanski, the director, about how this thing ends. Robert Town ends it with Faye Dunaway slaying her father and being arrested for the murder of this of her father, and no one really knows why. And there's like this kind of like, which you know, the Robert Town defended is kind of like, it's kind of unsettling and depressing in its own way. There's still no justice there, but there's a little bit of like, well, at least this girl's not going to go into the clutches of this pedophile's hands and get, you know, the cycle of abuse is going to be perpetuated. Roman Polanski is like, no, that's not good enough. This mother going to try to protect her child in that way. She's going to be slain by the police, get her head blown off, and then the rapist pedophile grandfather is going to usher that girl away, and Jake is going to be helpless to do anything about it because it's Chinatown. I felt like that was because I wasn't expecting a conventional good guys win. I didn't think anyone would leave this movie happy, but like, as bleak as it ended, it kind of bothered me. I don't know. I didn't think the film was pitching that kind of heat.
Yeah, I agree. I was surprised by the ending. And that was the best part of the ending, is just it was not what I expected. And I think like it leaves you in a place of despair, because that is what I wanted to happen. I wanted her to shoot him and this girl to get away from him, and you know, whether she's arrested or not, whatever, that's beside the point. At least justice will have been done here. Justice is not going to be done by the end of this movie. And I think it's more powerful for, it's making more of a statement. It's saying that the good guys don't always win, and that the moneyed interests, the powerful people who do bad things, will oftentimes get away with it. And to me, that is a much more on point message than, hey, you know, you can stand up and fight against this because you're on the side of right. That seems a little like Pollyanna for me.
Because I thought the understanding of the fact that this woman's going to go to jail probably unjustly, and the fact that, yeah, you stopped the one of these guys, but there's a whole bunch of other oligarchs that are going to, like Jake said to like two or three different dudes, like, hey, I'm not even after you. You can be fat and rich and well-connected and whatever. I want to get the guy who's on top. The fact that, like, they did defraud all of these ranchers, all these farmers, the people of Los Angeles, of their water rights to make themselves. And that's the thing. Not to make themselves rich, to make themselves richer. Which is something
that, future.
Yeah, there's something that
the
kind of
future,
resonates.
Mr. Gets the future.
And boy, you hear that when it's hard not to make connections to the wealthy elites today and them, setting their sights on Mars and building their copper rockets and who knows what sacrifices being justified in the name of the future.
No, this movie is still extremely relevant. I mean, nothing that happens in this movie, you can't look at this movie and say, look at that bygone era of the time when rich people used to fuck over the public and get away with it scot-free. You can't. You just can't. And if you are, you're willfully ignorant of things like this happening every day. And that's the thing to me that was so interesting about this movie, is it portrays this scheme, this grand conspiracy that was happening kind of in a smaller, I don't know, maybe not a smaller context, but basically happened 30 years before this movie is set. In the early 1900s. And if you think like it is just portraying one crazy situation that, you know, got out of hand and there was a conspiracy and, oh, it's good thing we discovered it and put it into all that, you're completely naive.
Yeah. I do think this stuff, it comes in waves, though. Like, you have where, like, you know, times are good and people are making money and the country's kind of booming and people take the, you know, there's a new technology a consolidation of, like, media companies in the case of, like, you know, the late 1800s, early 1900s is the newspapers. Now it's like social media. But these conditions arise where people can kind of like pull this massive cons on the public. And then it's exposed. You have the muckraking journalists. You got the Upton Sinclairs exposing all this stuff. And people kind of put their eye on the ball and things are good again until, you know, you forget and take your eye off the ball. It's like something like almost generationally that you have to learn that, like, you know, because I don't think that like corruption is ever present. I think it's something that waxes and wanes. And this is telling a time where it really was waning in at least particular parts of the country.
I always come back to the right. It kicked in a high gear. I always come back to the idea of money never sleeps. Right. Like, you may catch this one person doing this one bad thing and expose that, but I guarantee there are five other people doing the exact same thing in different arenas, and they are not being exposed and caught because either they were slightly smarter about the way they did it, or people just can't keep their eyes everywhere, right?
Well, one of the things I thought was brilliant about the film to build on that is, like, it shows this guy is a detective, but he's not doing anything crazy. He's essentially walking around, looking at things, seeing if they match the things that people are telling him, going to a public building and getting public records. Anyone could do this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's just who has got the time and the effort to spend days, if not weeks, going and poring over the public records and the plots and the land titles and writing down the names and finding who's in the obituaries and cross-referencing to old folks. Like, who's got the time to fucking do that? It's all happening in plain sight. It's all above the board. No, I guess people are being murdered. But other than the, like, one or two murders happen in the film, there's not even probably even laws being broke, right?
No, that's the thing. I think the plan in this is to divert water to an area of California that is not currently Los Angeles, but will be by the time that they divert the water. And so they can technically claim that the water is going to Los Angeles. It's just going to the places they've recently purchased, which are now going to skyrocket in value.
And the Water Commission, there's a couple interesting, fascinating things in this film. So the Water Commission, number one, their job is to ration the water in the desert. So like what they're doing, like starving these farmers out, is like covered up by like, oh, well, you know, it's routine to divert water here and there because like this citrus valley is suffering here and this person near. And then like, you know, and this is just all it's all easy to kind of explain away. And the other thing is like the generation before, there was a person who owned the water supply, and his business partner had a philosophical disagreement with him. And they don't really go in and resolve this. And this is all based on like real life stuff. So a lot of the kind of like crazy questions about like why old folks and stuff are probably because that's the way it happened in real life.
Okay.
But like there's also this kind of like resentment that this guy who owned the water and was swindled away from him by the public as a resource, like he's trying to reassert that. You know, he's like trying to essentially claw, like, no, this shouldn't, you know, like this shouldn't be owned by the public. I'm trying to essentially claw it back just because I'm wanting to shape the future of Los Angeles. Yeah, I thought that stuff was really, 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 really interesting.
I do wish that by the end of this movie, we'd get some indication that the people who technically on paper own this, those people at the old folks home, would have like realized that they owned it and stolen it back out from under him. That would have been like the justice and maybe like sold it back to the city at like extremely reduced rates. And so he would have been just completely undermined in all of his plans. But of course, it's not that kind of movie.
Yeah.
I want to see done, though.
Why do you think they had the old folks?
I really don't know. So obviously they have somebody in the records offices, right? At Water and Power or whatever to keep kind of a marker for them, letting them know that, hey, you guys actually own this property, but we're going to put it under some other names. So My assumption is that there was some scheme where, like, when they died, it was going to somehow revert back to them.
Yeah.
And that's why they did the old folks people.
I have a slightly different interpretation of all that, but, like, I arrived at the same conclusion that the fact that these things, names are pasted over in a book is routine.
Uh-huh.
It's like, you know, this is like, these got sold this month and we'll replace the pages at the end of the month. But, like, you know, the shocking thing was, like, how much of the valley was up for sale. And then, it seemed like that this Albacore Yacht Club or whatever, this patron saint of this old folks home, had conditioned these old folks to, like, maybe people who are formerly wealthy, they take them in and provide a certain lifestyle and probably do, like, a reverse mortgage. And then it's like, oh, but you sign everything over to the Albacore company when you die. And you got all these old folks who, it's like, it's like taking out a 5-year certificate of deposit that might pay out next year. You know, it's like, there's no fucking way any of these geezers are going to make it past 5 years. So all we got to do is wait. And we have we've got all this stuff.
Not
it seemed
that,
like a pretty airtight scheme, honestly.
Yeah, except that Noah Crook. What's his name?
Noah Crook.
The old guy.
The water commissioner. Noah Cross. Okay.
He doesn't have much time to live either. He might die before any of these old folks people do, because I think they looked healthier than he did.
Well, and that's, I was wondering if they were saying something about that, the fact that, like, you know, he's preying upon, because these were, like, from the conversations we had, the few conversations we had, the old folks, they seemed like they were wealthy people of means that had lost everything, and he's kind of, like, preying on them. He's like the spider that keeps sucking on the other smaller spiders and getting bigger and bigger, but they never really do anything with that.
They don't, and they don't connect those dots quite as well as I would like them to where I could understand it.
Can I ask you, what the fuck is going on with Faye Dunaway? Like, I understand the Faye Dunaway, her daughter, and the John Huston situation. You know, he's a wealthy, powerful man who preys on his daughter, gets her pregnant at 15. She runs away to Mexico to protect her from that. He's trying to get her close. Like, what I don't understand is Faye Dunaway's husband, who is this guy's business partner and the one that kind of starts to blow the lid off the situation. And John, old ass John Huston, he's hardy enough to murder that guy.
Apparently.
Why is he dating his wife's incest baby? Or was he just spending, like, stepfather daughter time? No, they were definitely fucking, right?
I think so. I that whole thing got really fucking weird, and maybe appropriately so, but
this is where the Roman Polanski of it all kind of, like, oh, well, if you find a young girl in a dire enough straits and you take her in under your wing, and like the way Faye Dunaway is like, oh, he's just so kind and he's this, and, you know, my father's this monster. It's like, I want him to be and you combine that with the John Huston speech where, you know, he, like, self-righteously, when, you know, Jack Nicholson's starting to turn on the heat about, like, you know, why are you doing this? Why are you trying to make yourself rich? Why, you know, how can you do all these things? How can you take advantage of all these people? And he's like, oh, I think you'll find under right circumstances, anyone's capable of anything. Like, nah, dude, I'm pretty sure the majority of us put in a situation where we can prey. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'd be shocked, but I feel like the majority of people put in a situation to prey on 13, 14, 15 year old girls, let alone your own goddamn daughter, wouldn't fucking rape them. But like, there's a whole lot of, like, oh, well, if you are a wealthy benefactor, I don't know, man. It's like the whole, like, last 20 minutes of this movie just out of nowhere skeeved me the fuck out. Once they, that final puzzle piece. Well, plus, like, can we talk about the way that that information is delivered? Faye Dunaway
turns out is this
multi-traumatized teenage girl who's been raped and abused by her father. And Jack Nicholson literally beats this confession out of her. Like, tell me the truth, goddammit. Slap. Ah, she's my daughter. Slap. She's my sister. Slap. I mean, just went on and on and on. I'm like, oh, my God. Because I'd already, like, after the first slap, like, oh, I see where this is fucking going. I think guys like Jack Nicholson would roll that way and would kind of see things at this, and like, he asked her, it's like, well, did he rape you? And she, like, nodded no. And I'm like, well, but wait, you just said you were 15 when you ran away. But it's just the Roman Polanski of it all. Like, if it wasn't Roman Polanski, I'd be like, ah, it's the 1930s. Where do you go? But, like, Jesus, this is kind of a piece of apologia, I felt like a bit.
Sure, I could see that. Yeah, I was definitely squicked out by the whole thing, too. I think it's... I don't know. Do you think the movie is more effective for that? For that very squicky stuff happening at the very end and us getting a real view into just how bad a guy Noah Cross is. It's not just that he's willing to, you know, claim the bounty of this particular water contract for himself. It's also that he is just a morally bankrupt person in all regards.
That's a good question, because, like, I don't think there's anything that's off limits. Like, you know, if you're trying to show, and that's usually how, that's the one way you can gauge human empathy is, like, you know, the way Charles Dickinson showed the plight of, like, just really wretched orphans that had no, you know, like there's no system out there to uplift them and get them out of their misery. It's like, you know, telling painful truths, right? And it's fine, but I feel like it's I get uncomfortable when I feel like it's one thing, you know, if you're watching a movie where, like, cops are in a vice ring and they're busting a pedophile ring or whatever. It's another if I find out the director of that movie is a pedophile and he casts Kevin Spacey as the villain and he gives him a moment of human, like, I don't have a problem with humanizing villains. I don't have a problem with dealing with real human evil. It's just like, I prefer the yeah. know that my filmmaker wasn't secretly saying, well, actually, this could happen to any of us. And, you know, can we really feel too smug and self-righteous if we that? I guess that's the thing. So is it more effective? I don't know.
I feel you.
It's more effective in making me go, gah. Uh-huh. But
yeah, it certainly puts me off any defense of Noah Cross that I would make. But yeah, you're right. It gets extra weird when the people making the movie have perhaps motives different than what I would perceive just watching that myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. You know,
I wanted to talk a little bit about another bold choice in this movie that sets it apart from basically any other movie I've ever seen. And that is the choice to slash open Jack Nicholson's nose in, like, the first act of this movie and leave it slashed open and bandaged for the entire rest of the film. And the bandage work here is not like some clean thing where, oh, you just, you know, you put some stitches and a butterfly bandage on it. No, it's gauze, it's tape. It's like covering half his goddamn face through at least
scenes,
half
yeah.
of the goddamn movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is something that is not done in cinema for obvious reasons. You don't want to reduce the ability of your actors to emote. You don't want to reduce the ability of the audience to see this famous and handsome man on screen. There are so many reasons you don't do this, and the movie chooses to, and I think it's extremely bold and a great choice, actually.
Yeah, it does a couple things. It kind of sort of allows Jack Nicholson to disappear in the role more than I think he would otherwise. Mm-hmm. It also gives him a vulnerability very early on. Like, he's cowed and afraid and beaten down at this point. And also, I thought it was, especially the early goings of those bandages, where it really does cover everything but, like, his eyes and his mouth, that somehow that heightened his expression. Like, Jack Nicholson's got a snarl.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, the way he can twist his mouth in rage. And there's an early scene where he's, like, his eyes are blazing and his mouth. And, like, the fact that everything was just, like, it was like a white circle with these crazy demonic eyes and mouth on it, like one of those Japanese kabuki masks, you know, like, it turned him into that, almost like this ferocious thing. And it's also, like, I think that was at his peak. In humanity. Like, he's still just kind of in it and he doesn't give a shit about anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And as he regains more of his humanity and empathy for Faye Dunaway and, like, the community of LA, like, he gets more and more of a human appearance back. So at the end of the film, he just has like two X's over the slit on his nose. Do you think, is that where they're going for that?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to tie it into, like, the taint of the Chinatown stuff, right? You can also look at it as, like, something that is besmirching his feelings toward man in a way. Uh-huh. And this is kind of a reaffirmation of that, right? He gets his nose slashed open trying to hunt down the bad guy here, and figure this whole thing out. Yeah, I think it's a decision that makes a lot of sense in context of the plot, but also is just extremely bold for filmmaking.
Yeah, it's not, you don't see it very often that your A-list actor is put in huge prosthetics and whatnot.
Especially at the time. I mean, at the time, it's wild.
I thought there was such a huge gulf between some of the practical makeup work and some of the others. Like, for example, I thought Jack Nicholson's nose, when he finally saw it, and it's kind of like stitched up and so on, I thought that looked like a real nose had been slit. Mm-hmm. I thought Faye Dunaway, I was kind of shocked at how well her blown out eyeball looked. Like, she's just got this giant hole in her skull. I was like, wow, this is 1970s. This is interesting. There's a couple other things, you know, bruising and work like that. But then there's this one scene where he goes into the L.A. Records, Hall of Records, and he gets this, like, you know, insufferable kind of like Poindextery guy. And they've got this like crazy pimple makeup on it, and it looks awful. It looks shit. It intense. Looks like you went into Spirit Halloween, got the shittiest $5.99 latex kit, and gave some drunk film student a spatula to apply it with and said, here, make this look like the boiliest bubonic plague pimples that you can do. It's crazy. Yeah. It was distracting. Like, if I'm Roman Polanski rolling on that day, I'm like, you know what? Scrape all this shit off. This kid is skinny and pencil-necked enough that he's going to read as an insufferable geek. We don't need all this crappy pimple shit on him.
Yeah, that was a weird choice. Like, I assume this isn't just the actor's complexion.
No, God,
and
no.
They did this intentionally to him, so.
No, yeah, no, I'm pretty sure these were not real pimples. I've seen people with acne. They don't look like this, you know?
Sure. So I don't know, man. Yeah, it's a weird choice. There's a lot of that, actually. Like, you mentioned Faye Dunaway's eye in this, and there's a scene in this movie which feels strangely out of place. It happens during a romantic encounter between Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway, where he notes that she has an imperfection in her eye, like a black mark inside of the iris where the rest of it is green. And they're really on like these themes of imperfection between his nose and her eye and it getting blown out and this pimpled record keeper. I don't know exactly what they're going for there, but it's interesting. I need to see this again to see if I can tease out the themes there, or read people who've already analyzed this to death, because I'm sure it's out there.
Well, so I did a little bit of digging in this too, and I saw that, like, you know, contemporaneously of this movie coming out, people noticed that there's this theme of like perfection and flaws. Mm-hmm. Like, Jack Nicholson holds two pocket watches, one that's pristine, one that's shattered. You got a pair of spectacles. It's got one lens that's perfect. One that's got a crack through it. You got Faye Dunaway, one perfect eye, one that's got a blemish. That blemish eye is the one that gets blown out. There is all these contrasts. You got even Jack Nicholson on one side. He looks like he's regular Jack Nicholson. The other side, he's got this ugly scar going up his nose. Someone asked both the writer, both Robert Towne and Roman Polanski contemporaneously, it's like, what meaning? And they're like, oh, fuck, we actually didn't intend any of that. We were just compositing shots and doing stuff. And like, we had no idea we were putting. I mean, it's like it reminded me of True Detective season one, where the little girls, Marty's kids, had spiral. All these like yellow spirals and like portals to voids in their room, and like, oh my God, they've got inducted by the cult. And it turns out it was just like, oh no, one of our interior designers had a kid that was scribbling this shit, and he just put authentic kid drawings in this authentic kid's room, and that you guys. So, but it is such a strong fucking theme. It's hard to believe that they didn't intend it.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to call them liars and say, no, you intended this. You just don't want us. You don't want to clue us in on it. It's funny you mentioned True Detective Season 1, because I was getting very strong True Detective Season 2 vibes from this movie.
Yeah.
Like, they almost just crib the entire plot from this film.
Yeah, that's essentially. And on, so like, did you know this was intended to be a trilogy?
So at the end, when I was done watching, HBO suggested another movie for me, called a Jack Nicholson movie called The Two Jakes. And yeah. I made a joke in my head. I was like, oh, this must be, you know, the sequel to Chinatown, where he turns out to have a Mexican brother that, like, yeah. Right. It turns out, yeah, that is actually the sequel to this movie, which is crazy. Also written by Robert Towne.
Yeah, so there were three. It was intended to be a trilogy, and each one was going to be filmed like 15 years apart and show, like, you know, Jake in his prime, Jake in his, like, you know, retire, and then Jake in his old age. And it's all going to be about the theft of resources from the people of Los Angeles. The first one is about the water rights in the 30s. The mm-hmm. next one is going to be about the railroad and shenanigans and the oil shenanigans. Yeah, like the stand. Yeah. Yeah, in the 40s and 50s. And then the last one is going to be about land, the acquisition of land. And the second one flopped. Now, it's got a 67% on Rotten Tomatoes. Roger Ebert gave it 4 stars, says it was riveting.
The so, like, Two Jakes?
Yeah, so like, wow. I don't like, I definitely want to see it, because it sounds like if it's a failure, it's probably a creative failure. It has Jack Nicholson in it. It mm-hmm. is not obviously connected to Roman Polanski. Robert Towne did still write it, though. So, like, I don't know, but I definitely want to check it out. But it would have been neat to have like that trilogy of trilogy of corruption.
Yeah,
if that was as popular as Lord of the Rings, it might be good for civil discourse.
Yeah, I mean, I always appreciate when movies like this are made to at least bring to light the idea that powerful people could be doing corrupt things behind the scenes at all mm-hmm. times, even if they're so strictly much, legal. I don't know so what recourse you have when something they're doing is strictly legal, but, you know.
Oh, shit. Our producer Talitha just slid in chat and said that Jack Nicholson was a director of The Two Jakes.
All right.
Crazy. So now I definitely want to see it. There's so much things I appreciated about this movie. Like early on, there's this city council debate where you've got this one like businessman that's like, Los Angeles is caught between a sea of salt and a desert. And if we don't get water, we're going to die. We got to build this dam. It's going to be good for us, good for you, good for your mothers, good for business, blah, blah, blah. Vote for the dam. And he's like this dynamic, striding, confident person with soaring rhetoric. And everybody's like, yeah. And then you have like this nerd that gets up there and says, you know, this dam is going to be built on unstable sand shale, and it's just like the dam you built 20 years ago that killed 500 people, and you're repeating mm-hmm. the same mistakes, and like people are like, boo, get up, no, we want the, like, it, yeah, you've got the guy who just like, we want this to make money, and you got the other guy, it's like, this is going to kill you to make this money, and I'm pretty sure the dam probably got bought, and these people all got rich, and I don't know, maybe it killed another 500 people.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a tension here, right? Because it's not all about money. It's also about water for the people of Los Angeles.
And you know, which is life, yeah.
The people who want to make money here have been, they are accelerationists when it comes to the water situation in LA. They want to make it worse so that it will seem more urgent to build this thing, and they'll just get approval and then they'll get their money. And so they're doing that. But it's also a real concern. Like, you need water for the people of the city. And as they point out, we built this city in a fucking desert. Like, that, you know, none of this, the position of Los Angeles makes a lot of sense other than, boy, it sure is beautiful here.
Why did some of the crown jewels of America's cities get built in just the worst fucking place? Like,
it's still happening. Like,
no.
We just watched a... a prestige movie called Falling for Christmas, where they built, I don't know, it reminded me of the fucking ski slopes that are being built indoors in Dubai. Oh, like, we are still doing this shit. We built Las Vegas in the middle of nowhere in
a
desert and said, hey, everybody flock here to a place that doesn't support life, and we're going to party it up.
Can we take like, I think we should just dismantle LA or Los Angeles, maybe Los Angeles, but Las Vegas for sure should be torn down and rebuilt someplace in a major watershed. We should just like the federal should go like the Madison, Wisconsin and be like, all right, I don't give a fuck what you say, Wisconsin, 100 miles all around, legal prostitution, legal drugs, legal gambling. And we're not going to do this fucking Bellagio water shit in the desert. We're not going to do the, why are we doing this?
It's incredible too, in this movie, the very first thing I notice when he pulls up to the estate, the beautiful palatial estate of the Mulrays, is they have lush green grass everywhere. Yeah, they have palm trees. Their property is lined with trees, soaking up hundreds and gallons of water, tons of water. They have people maintaining their beautiful, sprawling gardens meticulously. They are they are not feeling the crunch of the water supply at all here.
No. And that's one of the big, I think, frictions of LA life today is that like the average citizen is told you can't do this, you can't do that, you got to do this, you got to do that, knowing full well that like there's celebrities that are, you know, have acres and acres of lush green vegetation. They're probably not following the water rule. And then you've got like, and then that says nothing about the industrial use that dwarfs residential consumption. It says nothing about the agricultural use that dwarfs. And, you know, there's, you know, like you got to do business, you got to feed people, right? But like,
but
it doesn't
do you need
feel like
to be
a very
growing
democratic or equitable.
Pistachios. Do you need to be
in the desert? Yeah.
Growing the most, water thirsty crops. Sure. Known to man in the desert.
It is fucking crazy. I also I want to do some more praise of the movie and not just do social commentary. One of the things that defines noir movies to me is like the kind of one-liners and like the clever writing. I thought there was a bunch of good ones in this one. Like when Faye Dunaway is busting Jack Nicholson for like taking pictures of her husband because they seemed like they had an open. Well, fuck, they got the openest relationship in the world. Like, yeah, you can fuck my daughter and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But he goes, hey, don't get tough with me. I was just, you know, hired to do a job. And she turns around. And she goes, I don't get tough with anyone. My lawyer does. And just walks out of the room like a fucking boss. This is a nonverbal part. But like after she gets out, you know, she saves Jack Nicholson's neck. She drives him off under a hail of bullets. Like there's a scene where she's just kind of coolly checking her makeup in the mirror as she's driving away, which I thought made her look like a fucking badass. Jack Nicholson has a sick burn on this corrupt ex-lawman who's now the bodyguard for this shadowy cartel. And he says, don't worry. I remember this guy was sheriff during Prohibition. And like 200 million gallons of rum landed on this beach and he didn't spill a drop. I think your water will be safe with him. It's like, really, there's like so many great one-liners about that. I'm trying to think of what some of the other ones were.
I mean, there were some more crude ones about, you know, people's wives closing their legs and stuff. But
a couple
of pretty crude jokes in this movie.
I don't understand the screwing like a Chinaman joke. Like it felt like absurdist humor because like I literally didn't understand it.
Well, so it's racist, which might be why you're not picking up its wavelength.
I was trying to put my, you know, like the like in the National Secret, my racist decoder glasses to kind of like, okay, what?
And so the implication here is that the man's wife has slept with Chinamen, right? As the movie puts it. And because the people of the time see that as a negative thing, it's an insult to both the wife and the husband, right?
That's the implication. I thought they were trying to get at is like his love life was dead and he was looking for suggestions on how to improve it. And they're essentially suggesting tantric sex and they're describing to China. And the thing is that he tries something different. His wife complains because like she's read it in a Cosmo or something. She's like, why? Like, it's even worse than what you've done before. And that didn't make any fucking sense. I didn't go one base level racist that like his wife fucking a Chinaman would just be the worst. So, I thought she read it in Cosmo. She read about the Chinaman fucking techniques in Cosmo.
Probably Reader's Digest or something. I don't even know. Cosmo a thing in 1930? Probably
That's
not
a very good question. were women allowed to read back then? I don't know. They couldn't get checking accounts.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. And now, back with more Bald Move. One of the other things that makes this movie great is the score. I was really noticing the score throughout this film, and it is very propulsive. It's very intense.
Very horny.
At times. In very horny at sense, times.
A lot of brass instruments, just the warbling at that trumpet. Yeah.
And this is kind of a staple of the composer, who's Jerry Goldsmith. I mean, it feels like a specifically Goldsmith score to me. You think of things like his involvement in the Star Trek movies. I get notes of that throughout this film. Jerry Goldsmith, he's done a ton of popular films. He's one of the top three composers that worked in Hollywood in his era, I would assume.
Damn.
Right? I mean, who else? There's John Williams. There's
Saying that, like, you saw a lot of similarities, but also they're very distinct soundtracks, Star Trek versus this. And it's like, because that's the thing, one of the things that drives me nuts is when people say, like, oh, John Williams shit sounds the same. That's because you've only heard his marches. And yes, all heroic marches kind of do sound the same. But like, check out Catch Me If You Can. You fucking think that sounds like Star Trek or Superman or anything? No, that's pretty cool that he's. I think it's amazing that people have that kind of range.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really fit this movie.
The other thing this movie does is sells how like awesome being a private detective is, at least as it's depicted in the movies. Because like, you just get to kind of tail people and find out secrets, and you kind of fuck around, waste time, drive around, look at things, report back, take pictures. I thought the pocket watch thing was so fucking smart, too.
Right? I was amazed when I realized what they were doing with that.
Yeah.
Like, why? Why did he put this thing under the wheel?
Because that's why I was thinking, like, well, is like some kind of crazy GPS tracking device? But no, the guy has to pull, has guys to back out. He smashes the pocket watch. They know without staying there all night when he left. Like, that's fucking brilliant.
It is brilliant. Yeah. Then they try something similar later, which I don't think is nearly effective. I can't remember what it is, but pocket watch thing really got me.
Yeah, most of the stuff in just like the kind of Fletch style social engineering, where it's like, oh, the boss is gone, gone. Well, how long is he going to be? He's going to be gone, and then he's like, oh, well, then all this, I got my day cleared. I'll just wait for him in his office, and he helps himself into the office, and he's in there going through the drawers and stuff. Like I thought that stuff was really cool.
I think a lot of his ability to do that just comes from the fact that he's wearing a fairly nice suit, right?
Yeah.
Like the lieutenant
looks respectable.
Comments on it in one scene. He's like, oh, you look like you've done well for yourself.
He does. Like, normally you see these noir detectives kind of shabby and ran down. Mm-hmm. But like, it looks like that Jack Nicholson is well equipped. He's got operatives. He's got a secretary. He's got a nice office. He's wearing flash clothes.
Nice car. Yeah.
Do you think you could ever, because that's the other thing, is like every once in a while there'll be a thread on like Ask Reddit or something where a private detective like in modern day will be, you know, because they're still people wanting pictures of their spouse cheating, investigating insurance fraud and all that kind of stuff. Everyone says it seems like it's a pretty fun job. You're kind of putting together these little mysteries, and it's like all this stuff is like super publicly available. Just going down and like, let's pull up 7 years of this guy's tax records and all of his businesses and what land does he own, and just kind of look. And, you know, if you're just even tailing someone to get pictures of him cheating on her wife, seems kind of fascinating that you got to find out a person's routine and follow them around a bit. And I it seems like a cool gig.
I think Hollywood has made it seem that way. This movie makes it seem very exciting. It makes it seem very fulfilling when you get to blow a story wide open, right? And bust a high level criminal like this. But then it also makes it seem very dangerous. And I think the job is really none of those things. Or if it is any of those things, it's for very brief moments. And the rest of the time is a sea of mind-numbing just nothing, like looking through records. And it's similar to how I think of like IRS tax investigators or something. Like where they're just pouring through reams and reams of tax yeah. records and paperwork and shit. And then they'll find one little detail somewhere that points to a bigger issue here. And they go, aha, that's why I do my job.
And that's that dopamine hits where it's like Lester in The Wire. You know, he's the guy, he's going through all these green bar reports and he's just looking for like numbers that kind of don't look right. And you're right. Like, is that
but that happens
that
once
fun?
In a career? Maybe. I'm sure there are IRS agents who go through their entire careers, 30 right. years, 35, 40 years and never get a case like that. So,
right.
And PIs too.
The other side of it is even if it is like all these little mysteries that you're solving seem like they're all kind of sad, petty things. Like, you really feel good about busting someone who's been cheating the insurance company. Like, have they been cheating an insurance company? Do you really feel good about like blowing up a person's family and life and career? And there's like, there's no justice to be done. You're just kind of setting petty scores civilly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it looks cool. It looks fucking cool. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's cooler back in the day, like a lot of things.
Maybe. Can I ask you another question? That thing that I didn't understand. What's the meeting with the boy on the horse all about?
Oh, so like when Jack Nicholson was in his following the Mulvaney guy around to see if he was fucking around on his wife. One of the things he did is talk to this little boy. You're asking me what the little boy's doing riding his horse in this parched desert. Yeah. I can't help you with that.
Okay. Okay. Because I do remember, Mulray talks to the guy when Jack Nicholson's spying on him, and Nicholson goes and talks to him.
I see he's doing a chore. Like he's riding from the orchard to the city to pick up the mail or to do something on a daily basis, but. He's just a little kid, like 12-year-old kid with a sombrero. Just bareback riding his horse through the desert.
Yeah, and then there's a connection between like him barebacking his horse and Mrs. Mulray, Evelyn, saying she was out bareback on a horse for like a longer time than she seems to have been.
Oh.
Is this a connection to Mexico and her child, I assume.
Yes,
the movie does not ever connect those dots, though. It just kind of like throws
that is
a dot out
a
there and says,
somehow.
Connect it if you want, I guess.
Well, that goes like when I first saw Godfather 2, I didn't really know anything about the Cuban Revolution. I certainly didn't know anything about the mob involvement and the private enterprise involvement in Cuba and all that. So like, and I, you know, it's already a Byzantine plot without knowing the historical underpinnings. So it's like, it took me four or five times watching Godfather 2 where I'm like, I know exactly every gear and how it's moving and what it's doing. And I imagine this film was similar because, there was a couple of things that I thought they were laying thematic grounds and I just wasn't quite sure how to make the connection. But yeah.
Yeah. I've heard people say that this is the best script ever written.
Because everything connects. Everything is important.
Sure, and it has a lot of the modern day feel in that way, right? Like everything they're setting up early on is set up in a way that intentionally looks unimportant or trivial or like a red herring, but ultimately isn't. And I think that is very clever and very engaging. And I think the thing that it has above other screenplays of the era that I would point to and say maybe this is perhaps the best screenplay ever written, like The Godfather 2, maybe The Godfather 1, is it has that ending. That ending, I think, is so strong, such a bold choice that it might actually elevate it above some of the other scripts, which are a little bit more straightforward. They're still amazing scripts. I think The Godfather Part 1 and 2 are some of the best scripts and the best films I've ever seen. I don't think that's a bold statement.
They have kind of whopper endings too that say something searing about the moral condition of humanity.
But this feels uniquely like a whopper, right? Like that feels like it's a follow-on from everything that has happened in the movies. This feels like it is a punch in the gut in what you like, hope and expect of this movie.
Well, so the other thing I thought, and I'm so glad we got on this tangent because I had this nugget in my back pocket from like the 1930s to 1968, I think 69, Hollywood was under this congressional act called the Hayes Act.
Sure.
Which forbidden Hollywood for portraying in fiction public public servants acting in corrupt ways and police acting in corrupt ways. Mm-hmm. So imagine the impact on the American public, who for two generations has never seen, like, you know, your public officials portrayed as anything but the guardians of the state. Mm-hmm. And you see this kind of like awful thing, and you get to the end where I'm sure those audiences is like, Jake's got all the puzzle pieces together. Yeah. He's meeting with his old partner, who's lieutenant on the police force. He's got the old man kind of making a raving half confession to all this shit. Justice will be done. And not only is justice not done, the worst type of perversion of justice is done. And then the heroes kind of led away with being with the phrase like, you know, like, hey, Jake, let it go. It's Chinatown. Mm-hmm. There's no solving this thing. Like there's not even like a hint of like something to come. It's just like we lost. We, the main protagonist, we broadly speaking, the people of Los Angeles, and we broadly speaking, the American people have lost in this instance. And like, yeah, like the cultural impact of seeing that, it's kind of like Psycho. Like, we see that as a horror film, and it's like, it's kind of tame today, but like, oh my God, all that naked flesh, and oh my God, all that blood going down the drain, and the seeing the blade, and see, like, even though you didn't actually see it, they cut a few frames before it actually hits her body. The clear, like, people just didn't know what to fucking do because they'd never seen anything like that. I think that this must have been that kind of experience, because we had artificially kept these type of stories. Man, isn't that? That's also wild that, like.
That's wild. I mean, the censorship there is insane to me.
Well, especially since, like, that was right at the time where we were getting a handle on the right, you know, coming out of, like, the Gilded Age and all this, like, this just, like, decades of corruption and, you know, starting to curb it and gotten through. I don't know. I guess the lead up to World War II must have been a hell of a drug, you know, like.
Sure.
We must trust the government. We must have faith in the systems. We got to get, I don't know. But it's, that's in, this is the one of the first films that kind of took full advantage of, like, you know, fuck the code. The code's no longer binding us. The cops are crooked. The politicians are crooked. They're all in the pockets of millionaires.
What more example do you need of them being crooked than them saying, you can't say that we're crooked? Right? Like, right. You can't even have the idea in your head that we would do such things. That's pretty.
And I remember because, like, it's like I had a little microcosm of that when I was 13. I'd read comic books my whole life, and they were always under the Comics Code Authority, which had a lot of similar rules of, like, you can't show drugs being used, you can't show bullets penetrating people's bodies. And like in the early 90s, the comics
Spawn
were starting.
That up? What?
I remember the first time I saw Punisher fucked. War Journal, and like Jim Lee is drawing a Punisher just full body exploding dudes with bullets and shit, and like open wounds, and he's killing cops, and like I'm a 13-year-old in seventh grade, like, this is the fucking most metal thing I've ever seen. Like, I wonder if that was because Chinatown, like, was crazy successful. It won, was like nominated for 11 different awards and won like half of them, made like tons of money
for
its time.
It only won for the screenplay, but
shit,
but
I
it
saw
was
the guy
nominated
for
11.
For so many, wow. Well, I wonder what it lost to.
That's always a good question. I didn't,
you know what.
Look.
Yeah, this is always fun. Let's go back and play Oscar history.
Okay.
This would be the 1975 Oscars, I imagine.
Probably. And while you're looking that up, I also want to say that the hammer of this movie hits just as hard today. And I think that's why it has such staying power.
Oh, well, it ran up against The Godfather Part II.
There you go. There you go. See? I'm saying, I think.
Look at this fucking Murderer's Row. Best Picture, The Godfather Part II, Chinatown, The Conversation. Francis Ford Coppola,
Gene Hackman,
double dipping, which was another. That's the other thing fascinating. Did you know? I don't think we mentioned this on the conversation that is the same technique that Polanski was going for this,
the
where
POV stuff. Yeah,
you were trying to do a first person perspective without the use of voiceovers, and that just like Gene Hackman is in every frame of the conversation, so you know that he is, or it's from his point of view explicitly. Same thing. I thought that's wild that those two movies came out the same year. The Towering
Inferno.
I love
The Conversation. We have a podcast for The Conversation. I would encourage people to go watch The Conversation because it's amazing.
And I think I admired it more than I liked it, but like, yeah.
I just kept thinking of Rear Window the entire time I was watching this movie because of the suspense that it was building and the mystery it was creating. And I'm like, especially when I read people saying this is the best screenplay of all time, I'm like, is this better than Rear Window, which is just a masterclass in suspense?
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's works, better, even though it's different. Even, but
it's that's the thing about these old movies is like the great ones, even though you can tell they're dated, you're like, I don't know about this, I don't know about that. Like they still kind of have the remainder of the thing. Like it still packs the punch. Like, you know, rear view window. Is it Rear Window?
Or Rear Window, yeah.
Rear Window. I don't know why I was reviewing there. The Rear Window, like that the tension that they build, especially in that final act, is still fucking real. Psycho is still unsettling, and that reveal of the mother is still fucking creepy.
Yeah.
Even Nosferatu, we did that, like the 100-year anniversary of that last year. The core parts of that movie that were creepy are still kind of like strangely effectively creepy. So... Mm-hmm. It is fun to go back and watch. Like I mentioned, the Maltese Falcon. If you do like this film and you want to see like the original blueprint that that they are not only following but also subverting in key areas, I'd highly recommend checking that out too, because it's still is an enormously entertaining film despite being so primitive. Like the editing in that film will blow your fucking mind, and not in a good way. But, you know, that was back when they were like slicing things together in dim rooms with smoke, chain smoking 4 packs a day. And their attention spans weren't completely blasted by video games and rock and roll music. So
things moved at a more stately rock and roll pace. Music.
Yep. That's
It's amazing to me when I look at, you know, the awards that were going around, how influential Paramount and Robert Evans and Ford Coppola, the what do they call it, new Hollywood, like that whole movement that was happening around then, how just powerful it was.
And it must have felt, because like you got these young guys telling these unconventional stories free from all these moral codes for the very first time with all these crazy techniques, and these new actors were doing method acting and pioneer. It's like, yeah, no wonder it you know, it feels like a big evolutionary leap.
But then it's immediately going to get eclipsed by the next evolutionary leap in Hollywood, which I mentioned is Jaws. Yeah, the blockbuster, the marketing machine that is.
God, what if Hollywood didn't fall in love with the blockbuster and we had instead like the most films or these kind of like mid-sized films? Because like that's where the real interesting things happen. Like I love my Marvels and I love like my big science fiction epics. But like, man, you can't really beat a $20 to $40 million, like, you know, auteur film director working with a decent budget. It's not a shoestring. You know, you get the early Christopher Nolan stuff there. You know, he's like, God, you watch Memento and you watch Tenet and it's like, God damn, something was lost in the $200 billion here.
Yeah. I don't know what that looks like, but this was... I don't know. Is this a big budget movie for the time? $6 million. It's worth about $33 million today. It feels
Like I said, it's your perfect solidly
middle.
Film. That's where your weirdo indie films are. It's where your period pieces go. It's where
it's where quality and creative storytelling happens, as opposed to the blockbuster, which by its very nature is designed to appeal to as many people as possible.
The masses. And now it's like, now blockbusters are not even like the mass includes all of humanity. you have to play everywhere broadly. So anything else we want to talk about Chinatown?
I don't think so.
I will say this, if you know, we've got a lot of HBO fans because of the recent House of the Dragon, this is streaming free with its sequel. Well, it's not free. You have to pay for HBO Max, but I know a lot of you got it, and it's available now to watch, as well as The Two Jakes, if you want to see how the less loved older brother film turned out. I'm definitely going to check that out. So that'll do it for Chinatown today. This movie was selected by our patron executive producers from a slate of 3 movies that we gave them. They chose Chinatown. Next week, through the exact same process, they have selected Air Force One. A little something different.
Sure.
less
we,
more.
We put to them three Harrison Ford films, and that was the one.
Yeah. Yeah,
what Patriot were the Games, three? Clear and Present Danger, I think. I think it was Clear and Present Danger, Patriot Games, and Air Force One.
Huh. So two Tom Clancy's and a not Tom Clancy, a Tom Clancy-ish Tom Clancy. Yeah, it's less noir, more Tom or Harrison Ford punching out terrorists and throwing them off airplanes. Yeah. I'm excited. I've only seen this movie once. I remember really liking it.
Oh, yeah.
So we'll be back. And if you want to join, get in on the inner circle, break this conspiracy wide open of how we select the films here, you can support us at support.baldmove.com, become a new patron executive producer, and start voting on our weekly movies. We'll be back next week for Air Force One. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.